Welcome to Bina, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of Bina, our guests are cookbook authors and food writers Einat Admani, Leah Koenig, and Adina Sussman, who will discuss the rich nuances of Jewish food and culture with roots in Persia, Yemen, Libya, the Balkans, the Levant, and all the regions that contribute to the evolving food scene in Israel and in the diaspora. They are joined in conversation by Rabbi Zach Kamenetz. And now, join Rabbi Zach Kamenetz on stage at the JCCSF as he introduces our program.
Adina Sussman is a cookbook author, food writer, recipe developer, and consultant. Her two latest collaborations, Cravings with Chrissy Teigen and The Sprinkles Baking Book with Candace Nelson, were New York Times bestsellers. Along with co-authoring 12 cookbooks, including Sababa, which was just published, Adina has written about Jewish and Israeli cooking and food culture for Food & Wine magazine, The Wall Street Journal, Epicurious, Gourmet, and many others. Einat Admani is chef and owner of the Mediterranean-focused Balabusta, Kishkash, which is her love letter to couscous, and Taim, a chain of successful and craveable falafel restaurants in New York City, and author of Balabusta, Bold Mediterranean Recipes to Feed the People You Love, and most recently, Shuk. In 2014, she received an honor from the Carnegie Corporation of New York, recognizing Einat as an outstanding naturalized citizen who has made notable contributions to the progress of American society. Leah Koenig is a writer and cookbook author whose work has appeared in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Epicurious, Food 52, and Tablet, among other publications. She is the author of Modern Jewish Cooking, The Little Book of Jewish Sweets, The Little Book of Jewish Treats, and The Little Book of Jewish Feasts, as well as the newly published Jewish Cookbook. Welcome. Okay, hi everyone.
Hello.
Welcome all. So Adina, because you are a native Californian, you have home court advantage, and so I'll start with you. You were raised in Palo Alto to Orthodox parents who actually helped co-found the synagogue down there, Congregation Emek Bracha.
Yes.
And they also owned a kosher cheese shop. Is that correct?
Shop is maybe a bit of an embellishment.
Kosher cheese garage, maybe.
Yes, we sold kosher cheese out of our garage, and probably the most money-losing business in Bay Area history.
So. Well, then you're making
them proud.
It was more
of a community service, but yeah, yes.
You made Aliyah and immigrated to Israel in 2015 with your Jay spouse. And I'm wondering, as an immigrant living in Tel Aviv, where does your history as a California girl show up most in your book, Sababa?
First of all, I have a long history with Israel. My parents were living there the year before I was born. I was almost a Sabra. There's a big thread, I think, between Northern California and Israel in the produce. I feel sometimes when I see like a loquat or a certain type of fig that people in other parts of the country aren't familiar with, they sort of take me right back to my upbringing and people just dropping fruit on the front porch. And one of the recipes in the book is a persimmon loaf that my mom used to make with all the extra ripe pomegranates, persimmons that were around. And I like using that history and sort of implementing it to my cooking, and just in general, my whole approach is to not deny my Americanness, but to sort of incorporate it into my cooking while celebrating everything that Israel has brought into my kitchen life and my life in general. So there's definitely a strong connection there.
Well, as I mentioned to you on the phone just the other day, you know, my wife and I are continuing to pass it back and forth from each other. I'm very excited to read it. And there are certainly some recipes that we continue to say only a Californian could have written these. And so we'll maybe talk about some of those a little bit later. So your book, Sababa, which I have here, fantastic book.
Thank you.
Some of you might know is the Arabic word for awesome, or everything is awesome, or amazing, wonderful, cool.
The Arabic word actually means the highest form of love. Oh. It's sort of a high Arabic word.
Better.
It's a beautiful word. And Israelis sort of took it and slangified it to mean everything's cool, everything's awesome. So a lot of Israelis have Arabic background and speak Arabic and knew the word in its original form, but it came to mean something else in Israel, and it's sort of taken hold and remained as a slang word that's used all the time in a million different contexts in Israel.
So if your cookbook is named Sababa, then how is this an example of the highest form of love for you and how it shows up in your life?
I mean, I think the way I envision the book is more the Israeli interpretation of the word than the original. Obviously, I have a huge love of Israel, and I was raised in a super Zionist religious home. And but what I really found in living in Israel is that the style of cooking is different. It's more laid back. There's either a lot of Shabbat cooking, like long cooked dishes that are made before Shabbat and then cook overnight so that you can have people over and sort of have a low stress meal, or a lot of quick salads, things you have in the fridge or things you can throw together quickly. And, you know, I had to kind of unwind 20 years of my New York personality where, you know, someone stopping by spontaneously is scheduled 2 weeks in advance. And in Israel, people are just always popping by the shuk, by our house, because they're at the shuk. And I wanted to develop a style of cooking where I always had things around that I could share with people. And also just realizing that nothing has to be done when people come over. You can be relaxed, you know, get people involved, show them the mess, make people feel at home in the kitchen. And so that sort of loose, I think Israeli cooking now is as much about the ingredients and the way they're combined and all the influences as a vibe and a sort of mood, like a more relaxed and laid back, sunny, spicy kind of way of cooking.
And there are a number of recipes where you actually give notes to the people reading. Like specifically, I can think about your za'atar and chicken recipe with sumac potatoes, where you specifically say, you can entertain this way. Right?
Yeah.
So you're giving an invitation not only for the food, but also for that style that you are trying to communicate.
Yeah, I mean, I love a whole chicken. You just throw it in the oven with potatoes and you've got a meal. But I've been seeing a lot of people posting that recipe with cut up pieces of chicken or using carrots instead of potatoes. And just in general, I've developed thousands of recipes for work over the years. And because I have to be so technical about my work, my personal style is so much more loose. And even though my recipes are all written to be followed, like I view recipes as guidelines and inspirational ideas that you can sort of mix and match and change to your liking. And I'm having the most fun seeing the way people are kind of improvising with the recipes and changing things.
Well, I think maybe it was not this past Shabbat, but last Friday night where I quickly Facebook friended you and then sent you a picture of my Shabbat dinner before lighting candles.
Thank you.
Just to let you know that it was
really
something that had already come into our house and we're really excited about.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Well, you have been well known for being Chrissy Teigen's cookbook collaborator.
Yes.
And you've been featured alone as an author as well and a recipe developer, like your column in Hadassah magazine.
15 years and going strong.
There you go. Season to taste.
Yes.
But could you share with us your creative process of writing as a standalone author for what is probably the first time in a cookbook such as this?
Sure. I've always been really comfortable supporting others and their work, and I always joke that if I weren't doing my job, I'd be like a personal assistant to a high-powered executive. I like sort of keeping things in order for someone and helping behind the scenes and having them incorporate my ideas and what they're doing and having this dialectic kind of emerge from the work. And when I had the opportunity to write my own book, I sort of had a bit of despair, like, A, do I have enough of a voice of my own and what to say that people are going to be interested in saying? And after spending more than 10 years channeling others' voices, especially in the narrative, but also in cooking, like, it took me a few months to reestablish, like, a personal voice and style and to have that confidence. But once I got going with the recipes and the writing, like it really started to, like the cogs in the wheel started to click really well. And I had a lot of fun with it. Definitely a lot of sleepless nights before the book came out, like wondering, you know, I've always been so lucky because I help people deliver these babies and then I get to go home and they have to raise them, like promote them. And this is the first book that I have to stand behind and promote and share and sort of continue to nurture like throughout this process, and I'm really having a lot of fun with it, and it's been a good exercise for me.
Well, I know that you're going to be on the road for a while, and you've been in California and then left and came back.
Yeah.
So we're just so grateful that you were able to come back home for this event.
Thank
you. And we'll come back to you and talk
about
some. So nice to
be here, and so amazing to be here with my two good friends, all of us from New York.
Yeah. And there will be an opportunity later for all of us to speak together, but right now, just talking individually. So, Einat, with your wonderful book, Shuk, that I have, I've been carrying these around like the Talmud, really. Like, my bag has just been heavy. You have spoken a lot about being raised in a mixed Mizrahi family, raised by your Yemenite father, your Persian mother, who was raised in an Iraqi household, and surrounded by Jews from the Mediterranean, North Africa, and the Near East. Growing up near the Carmel Shuk in the 70s and the 80s, what were you learning about being Israeli and Jewish amongst so much mixing and blending of Jewish ethnic tradition?
Wow.
That's mean you eat a lot.
Yeah.
Okay. Actually, everything is surrounded around food. My I grew up in actually in Nebrak, very close to Tel Aviv, and the Shabbat dinner and with the Orthodox family, they got religious and got stronger and stronger by the years. But we always have Shabbat dinner. That means I need to start preparing on Thursday, and I cannot get out until the end of the dinner on Friday night. And then I need to be back and ready and not party too much on Friday so I can wake up to help at 8 o'clock when my dad comes back from the synagogue. So basically a horrible childhood. No, I always joke with my friend and I have two kids, I always look at them and I'm like, wow, they got it good. Every time when my daughter started getting spoiled and things is around, I said, do you know that at your age, I used to scrub floor, and my mom used to let me scream 2 kilos of rice, grain by grain, sure that none of it's going to have any black dots. I used to peel a lot of fava beans, and every little thing's like, because she was not just observant Jew, she also was OCD and super clean, so everything, yeah.
Doubly blessed.
You laugh now. I didn't back then, but yeah. So it was super interesting. I think that at the beginning I really hate that. It wasn't something very close to me. I just felt like, oh, I want to get out of it. And later on, I always say that this has become the engine of my career. Being learn how to be a great wife one day, a perfect housewife. I learned how to sew. I learned how to clean. I learned how to change diaper very early. Everything that a woman's supposed to. Back then. And I used to, I always look at it as a super oppressive and demeaning. And it's funny that today I take all of it and it's helped me a lot during my career.
So where was that shift for you from having this lived experience of feeling like oppression, your surroundings, what you were being asked or made to do, and now like seeing it as a blessing or training or preparation for what your life is now?
Because it's later on when my mom promote me to be a sous chef and not any, and I start like dealing with more food and touching and creating and make the sauce and make the soup, I start fall in love with it. And I always liked to eat. I was the big eater in the family. So I always explore more than anyone else. And I think I found myself later on in my mid-20s that there is nothing I can do that will keep me excited, continue excited. Like I traveled most of my life, and everywhere I went, if it's a military time, and I lived in Europe for 5 years after, and everywhere I went, I just find myself cooking for everyone. Like if somebody said he's hungry, I'm like, oh, I need to cook for him, he's hungry. And I found myself just cooking, and when I decide, I was 25, I was living in Germany back then, and I said, okay, I need to find what I'm going to do. Like, I realized very young that college and university and years of education is for other people. And I need something that is more creative, that I need to move, and I need to... And I went back to Israel, and that's It came easy. They always ask me in interviews, what you would do if you're not a cook? I said, unemployed. So.
Well, we're glad that you are a cook, and we're glad that you are a restaurateur and a cookbook author. And your new cookbook, Shook, is for me like a reading walking tour of the culture and vibrancies of the open-air markets, the vegetables and the fruit, the spice shops and the meat and fish sellers, the bakeries and the cheesemakers, and the restaurants, most importantly, all around Israel. You give the reader an intimate education on fundamental ingredients of Israeli cuisine, writing about tomatoes and rice, which you just mentioned, with great care and great deference. What makes the Shuk so special to you?
A lot of memories. So my dad born next to the Shuk in Shabazi neighborhood. He born in Israel before it was Israel. And it was right next door to the Yemeni quarter, and he was his family from Yemen. So I remember, even though we have our own Shuk around Pardes Katz that is much closer, he used to take me to Shuk HaKarmel because he wanted to eat these soups. Mm. And even though my mom made them, she could never make them as an original old Yemenite woman. And also my mom never make lachuch. It's one of the bread that we grew up. That's the one, I think the only thing she never learned how to make. Later on we realized because she never liked to eat it. That's the reason. So we used to go back to the Shuk and he'd pretend that he's going to do all the shopping over there because he want to get his fix with the Yemenite soup and the lachuch and the chilbe, the old sauce next to it. So we used to go a lot to Shuk HaKarmel and get things. So I remember this time was my dad passed away 4 years ago. So I remember this strong memory. He was very much like me. We liked to eat. Mm-hmm. He was very open to eat a lot of new things as long as they're very kosher. But he was super open to, you know, there is people like my mom that will be picky and always complain and this and that, and he will just like enjoy it. And it was nice to see when we used to go to Zecharia. It's a small shop that just closed a few years ago, and we would sit there and see him, how he enjoys, like bring him back to his, you know, grandparents and his mom. And it's
amazing. So it sounds like the Shuk has been part of
it. It was an excuse.
Family.
But for me also, it's funny because for me, we Mizrahi, so we loud and super loud. And for me, the Shuk is like just being with all my cousin and my family. Everybody's screaming and it's like, just feel like home.
Totally.
The Shuk is something that in some ways, in my experience living in Israel for several years, there are aspects that have probably have not changed for a very long time, particular vendors that have been there for forever and always. But the Shuk is also developing in really incredible, magnificent, some people would say, hard ways, especially if you're trying to get your groceries done and now you're around people who are dancing and in bars. But for you, what are the most amazing and powerful changes that you've seen in Shuk culture in Israel for the past 10 years or so?
I think Shuk HaKarmel and Adina, I heard she became the queen of Shuk HaKarmel now.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. So
I just live there.
We can have two queens. It's okay.
No. But so when I going to, we just celebrate my son Bar Mitzvah this summer.
Mazal tov.
We've been, and when we get apartment, we always get as close as we can to Shuk HaKarmel. But the fascinating things for me is to see that serious chef opening restaurant around. And Shuk 20 years ago was, nobody go there to hang. They go to shop because it's the cheapest.
And you couldn't give away real estate in the neighborhood.
No, like, it was the cheapest place in Tel Aviv, not the most expensive area. So it's funny to see how things, actually it happened all around the world. You see that in New York a lot. And I think the Shuk is a great example. You have a lot of, also diversity a little. You have these guys with arepas, not just Israeli food. There is a guy that's screaming, the Bore guy, that have like this specific Tunisian dish that he make. And there is some serious chef that open restaurant right around the Shuk. And it's so easy. And it sounds like a dream. You go in and you have all this perfect produce to cook your favorite dishes with. Yeah.
Thank you. And we'll come back to some dishes that you have in Shuk as well.
You're listening to food writers Einat Admani, author of Shuk, From Market to Table, The Heart of Israeli Cooking, Leah Koenig, author of The Jewish Cookbook, and Adina Sussman, author of Sababa, Fresh, Sunny Flavors from My Israeli Kitchen. They're joined in conversation by Rabbi Zach Kamenetz on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Leah, you've been writing about Jewish food publicly at least since 2005, but before that you had a passion for environmentalism, philosophy, and religion at your time in Middlebury, where you graduated in 2004. How is what you're doing now with Jewish food, and for a long time with Jewish food, an outgrowth of your previous interests?
Sure. Before I started writing full-time, I worked for an organization called Hazon, which folks here, many of you probably know, and I ran a lot of their food programs. But for me, like, food is all about stories, it's about connections, it's about, it's about so much more than the actual taste of the food. And so I feel like whether you're talking about it from an angle of sustainability, which is what I studied at Middlebury. Middlebury has a program for environmental studies and religion and how they intersect. It's like maybe the only program in the country that does that. And I was like, yes, that's where I want to learn. So whether it's that or whether it's thinking about, Jewish culture and history and kind of how that shapes food, like, to me, it's all part of the same story. I don't write so much about sustainability specifically anymore, but it's in all of the work that I do. And I only buy Grow and Behold meat at home. I don't know if people know it. It's a kosher, sustainable meat company run by my good friends Naf and Anna, and it's just like the highest, most delicious meat in the world. So I think it's less of an outgrowth, and it's more that it's just all the same story for me.
Thank you.
Yeah.
This is kind of a little long one. I geeked out on one part of your career. Anyone around the Jewish internet in the mid-2000s knows from your work as an editor-in-chief of the Jew and the Carrot blog, as well as your contributions to online journals such as Zeke and Juicy. Mm-hmm. In 2006,
rest in peace, both of them.
Yes, both of them.
All three of them.
We have moved on.
Yeah.
Jew school is still around. You once wrote an article called Goldburgers and Cheeseburgers, Food and Particularism Among American Jews.
I love that article.
In it, highly recommended. In it, you quote Queen Bee herself, Claudia Rodin's use of the term fress from Migkeit. Did I say that correctly? Or culinary Jew, which was used in the 19th century Europe to describe assimilated Jews who expressed their Jewishness through their cultural traditions. Now that you have a very global perspective in this beautiful book, The Jewish Cookbook, and having dedicated so much energy in writing about the global Jewish perspective, do you see similar patterns happening, identifying deeply with food and food alone, in other cultural traditions aside from European culture, European Jewish culture?
Yes. This is sort of a tangential answer, but the thing that struck me most about working on this book, researching this book, and really about the writing I do about, Jewish food in general, is that Jewish food is this global cuisine that spans, everywhere from India to Mexico to Uganda. But wherever you go, there is this through line of connection. And there's this through... I'm sounding like such a hippie. I'm sorry.
You're in the right place. Everything's fine.
Yeah, there's a through line of just, like, the holidays and why you're getting around the table with each other and, like, the joy of food. And I think that you... Whether people kind of only identify as Jews through the food that they eat or whether it's part of a larger thing, I think that story is the same. But one of my favorite examples is there's a wonderful woman named Biji Barhani who runs a restaurant called Sion Cafe in Harlem. It's an Ethiopian restaurant. She is an Ethiopian Jew who walked to Sudan with her family when she was like 4 years old and was airlifted as part of the larger mission to bring Ethiopian Jews to Israel, and did army, moved to New York, whatever. She's an awesome woman. I was writing a story about Ethiopian Jewish food, and I got to cook with her. This was before the book, although two of her recipes are in the book. And I was over at her house, and we were making dorawat, which is like a chicken stew, and we were making kikwat, which is a lentil stew. I had either never had them before or certainly not, you know, very many times. So they were dishes that were totally unfamiliar to me. But we were in her kitchen. It was Friday morning. Her little kids were running around. The air was scented with onion and with ginger and garlic. And there was just this like, oh, yeah, this is Jewish, right? There was this like very deep sense of connection and that food that felt similar, even though the food was entirely different than what I grew up eating. So that to me is fresh from kite, right? Like that's being a food Jew.
Yeah, food Jew.
And I think you can be really religious and be a food Jew, and you can be completely secular and be a food Jew. So, yeah.
It's good that we can all be around something together.
Yeah.
And that it's food or talking about meals that we have eaten in the past.
Yeah.
Either food that we're eating now or will be eating later as well. Well, in the Jewish cookbook, you have the full spectrum of the global Jewish culinary experience. From recipes that are thousands of years old, like matzah, to unique and mostly modern recipes like Mexican chocolate babka. In your view, what is critical about capturing the depth and breadth of Jewish foods from around the world at this moment in the present of Jewish culture?
I love that question. I mean, Jewish food, I think one thing that people get wrong about Jewish food the most is that it doesn't change, that it's like been the same since your bubby made it. And really, Jewish food evolves constantly, and if it doesn't evolve constantly, it dies. Because, you know, Jews are constantly moving, being kicked out of places, whatever, like whatever the history is, like Jews move around a lot, as we all know, and they take their foods with them, and they adapt, and they, you know, they add in, you know, ingredients from other places, from their new home. Mexico is an amazing example, right? Like you're finding chefs who are now, they have Ashkenazi backgrounds, but they've been there 2 or 3 generations, and they're topping chicken soup with cilantro and diced avocado and diced white onion, or they're simmering the soup with the chipotle pepper and giving it like a smoky depth. So I kind of forgot what your question was because I'm now thinking about that soup.
Why now? Why? It sounds amazing. It's almost Friday, so that might be what's on the table at my house.
I remember your question.
But why now? Why capturing Jewish culture, culinary culture now?
Jewish food is constantly evolving, and so every book that is written about Jewish food, especially books like this that try to get a global perspective, are really capturing a moment in time. Yeah. You know, I look at Claudia Roden's Book of Jewish Food, which is to me like a culinary Bible. And I, you know, in the back, I mention a lot of my culinary heroes, Joe Nathan and Gil Marks and all the Joyce Goldstein. But her book, as perfect as it is, doesn't really include any Ethiopian recipes, for example, because 30 years ago when that book came out, like that cuisine was sort of just becoming part of the conversation in a larger way. So I think any Jewish book is really like capturing a moment right now. And so that was my goal. It also is also why I left out certain recipes.
For example?
Pcha? Are there any pcha fans here? Clap if you left. Does anyone know what
half
it is?
Half a fan.
Okay. Pcha is calf's foot jelly. It's basically aspic that has like gristle and garlic and like fat in it.
It's great on challah.
It's so not great.
No, that's what my grandmother told me. My grandmother told me it was
great. It is super nostalgic for a certain generation of Jews. It's a lovely dish and concept, but I just don't feel like the 21st century want to hang with aspic anymore. So I didn't include it. I mention it, and I talk about its importance, but so that, you know, 30 years ago, that recipe would have been in the book if I was writing it. Now I don't think we need it.
Hey, some things don't make it sometimes.
Right.
Yes, that's
so
right.
So I was trying to say, what are we eating now? Around the world.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So this question is for all of you. What is the one thing that people need to start cooking first from each of your books?
Mm. Oh, I know.
Choosing among your children.
What is it going to be?
I feel like Adina, the blondies.
I mean, what I've seen so far, what people are making, like a lot of my food looks familiar but tastes different. Something I didn't really realize when I was writing the book. And in general, you know, because so many great chefs preceded me with books about Israel, like Einat and Michael Solomonov and Elon Shaya, I was trying to figure out what I could contribute to the conversation about Israeli food that was different. And I decided to let go of the idea that I had to represent everything and tell a very personal story focused around the shuk, where I live, and the way that I cook. And a lot of the recipes do reflect that kind of duality of my upbringing. So, like, a lot of people are making the tahina blondies, which is, it looks like a delicious blondie bar, but, you know, in my childhood, something like that would have been made with peanut butter. Obviously, mine is made with tahina. Israelis are the second largest per capita consumer of tahina in the world, after the Chinese. And I add two kinds of toasted sesame seeds, and then I add cardamom, so that the minute you bite into those, it transports you, like, right back there to Israel. Perfect. And I always want everything that I make to sort of have that effect, you know. It's familiar, but with a little bit, and also still authentic to something Israeli. So that's one. And then my book is kind of centered around a series of condiments and staples at the beginning of the book, like spice blends and schug, which is a hot Yemenite hot sauce, or like two kinds of preserved lemon paste, so that when you make a few of these things, you can make dozens of recipes with them. So that's what it seems like people are focusing on, because it gives them a lot of flexibility. And there's a really great 24-hour cured lemon condiment. Yes. That is from M25 in Frevid, of Einatz as well, a steakhouse near the Shuk. And, you know, he takes the idea of a preserved lemon that usually takes anywhere from 2 weeks to 3 months and distills it into a 24-hour process by curing the lemons really thinly sliced in salt with jalapenos and garlic. Mm. And then you blitz it in a blender with a little bit of canola oil, and you have this really bright, salty, lemony, zesty, because the skin is still really part of it, and it just goes everywhere in my book. It goes on steaks. You can stir it into yogurt, and then I always have a jar of it in the fridge. So I make often like a pasta dish where I toss that with, I fry some garlic, I caramelize some of the condiment, I toss it with pasta, and then I take some good Italian tuna with olives and fresh peas and chili, and make sort of this really bright, sunny, spicy pasta dish.
What are you doing for Shabbat?
That was just to give an idea of how I cook and how I use all these things, because the thing I like the least is when you either make or buy something and it just goes stale or past its prime in your fridge or your pantry. So I'm always looking for, like, unique ways to use all the things I make or buy.
Thank you. Hey, Nat, what's the first thing?
I want to see what Leah is choosing for.
Leah, what is the first?
Yes, I know. Oh my gosh!
What's the first thing? Do you want to look through the book while we?
It's
hard to choose.
It is really hard to choose. It's almost like impossible.
That's why I will. Yes, please.
So a few come to mind. One is these amazing chicken fritters. I actually made them the other day. I cooked them live on Instagram. Yes. They are a dish from Calcutta. There's this wonderful woman. She's, I think, 89. Her name is Flower Silliman. She lives in Calcutta. She was born there, grew up there, raised her family there, moved away, and then moved back because she thought the Calcutta community was too small. It's literally like 12 people. Like, there's 12 Jews left in Calcutta. They live in Israel now. But so she has self-published a few cookbooks. One's called Three Cups of Flour, which is really sweet. I talked to her on the phone, and which is what I did a lot of, like, talking to you know, elders and to folks who have been doing this a lot longer than I have. And she's like, well, obviously we can't meet, but my daughter lives in Coney Island. So I drove to her daughter's house and got her cookbooks to, you know, obviously not for the recipe, but for the idea. So one of them is this dish called Aruk Tahin. I'm probably saying it wrong, but it's a chicken fritter with an entire bunch of scallions, jalapeno. You could do other chilies.
It's also Iraqi, you know.
Yes.
That, right?
Well, because the Calcutta...
I have it in the book.
Oh, you do?
Aruk, I grew up on it. I love that. That was the dish I won, but now I'm going to figure out a different dish.
Great. Well, okay.
So the Calcutta Jewish community.
They have a lot of connection with the Iraqi.
The Calcutta Jewish community is originally from Syria and Iraq, so it's a lot of dishes. But so there's fresh ginger in it, there's cilantro, and it's just, you blitz it all in a food processor. So it's almost like a thick pancake batter. That's the texture you want, and then you fry them, and they're so fluffy, and they're so like vibrant and they stay green when you fry them. It's the weirdest thing. Like the outside is brown, but you open it up and it's just like bright green. You can do it with fish also.
I do it
or
veggie.
Rice.
In my book, it's veggie with potatoes.
Oh my gosh. Mm. People need to do like an arouk side by side.
Arouk is one of my, it's...
I'm going to try your version.
Yeah.
So that's one.
That's
and then
good.
Another one, it's the opposite end of the spectrum. There's a lot of recipes in the book that are like quick 20 minutes just because Jews eat every day, not just on Shabbat and holidays. But one of the more, surprise, we eat every day. One of the more project dishes, which I love, is the Alsatian Kugelhopf. So Alsace in France is basically like the birthplace of Ashkenazi cuisine. Before it became Eastern Europe, it was like where France and Germany meet. And there's this amazing, it's almost like a panettone. Uh-huh. It's like a cake bread. It has its own pan. They're $20 on Amazon. They're totally worth your investment. Don't make it in a bundt pan. It's not the same thing. But it's filled with like dried fruit and almonds and lemon zest. And it's just the most delicious. Like,
is it really eggy?
It's very buttery.
Buttery.
Mm. Yeah. So it's a very like brioche, but like, well, not really brioche. It's like sturdier than that. But it's such an amazing bread, and it takes a while to make, but it freezes really well, so it's a wonderful thing to have around when people drop by. You put it in the toaster, you slather some butter on it, and it's like the most delicious thing.
That's good.
I'll stay with those two.
And now what do you think?
So no arouk. I want to say something. When I came to the state in 99, nobody knew that Jewish food is more than matzah ball. Nobody knew that there is more than the brisket and the Ashkenazi food, because everybody knew just Ashkenazi Jews. And I remember that I worked at the David Boulay restaurant, and I have two friends. One was African American, and one, my best friend today, Donald, is Irish, and I invite him for dinner and I make kubaselek. And they was like, what is that? They never had anything. So a lot of time I used to invite American and people from all around, and they was always shocked. Like, I'm like, that's how I grew up. I said, no, but Jewish cuisine, it's totally something else. I'm like, okay. So one of the recipes that I did, there is not a lot of Ashkenazi food, I have to say, maybe just a little, but one of the things I did, because it's, like Adina said, it's very hard. A lot of people doing Israeli cuisine and Jewish cuisine, so it's, I have to, like, you know, have a twist of my own and bring something new. And I took the beet kube that I grew up, and instead of to do the sole, the semolina around, I took the matzah meal. So basically we have a matzah ball stuffed with ground beef in a beet and celery broth that is Iraqi style.
Beautiful. Yeah.
So basically combine the both world and make one dish. It's even better than the original because it's much softer.
Yeah.
So okay. and it's more forgiving. So basically when you work with it, a lot of people have trouble with the semolina and how to make it, and it's breaking in a soup. This one is much easier. So you make a very thin layer of matzah. It's pretty delicious.
Gorgeous. Everyone's talking and I'm like starting to think
so
about
sorry.
My Shabbats, my holidays, my Rosh Hashanah. Like, where are these all going to fit in?
No, but there's like a...
It's exciting.
It's interesting, like the Talmud evolved, like, you know, it's people conversing and things going somewhere else. Like, this is how Jewish cuisine advances. Mm. You know, like this, in 20 years, this could be something that's in the permanent canon of
It's very
of
young,
Israeli
it's an evolve, and it's
changing all the time. And especially in Israel, someone like Inat, like, she feels the freedom to take from all of these different ethnic traditions, because she grew up in a place that has like almost 100, you know, in a country of 9 million people. So, yeah. You know, that's what I think is so special about Israeli food, but it's happening all over the world with Jewish food. You see like a French Israeli restaurant in Paris that's combining, and, you know, right now it feels trendy a little bit, but there are definitely elements that are going to just stick. Like 30 years ago, balsamic vinegar was a trend. Right. Like, no one had it in their pantry, and
So it was olive oil.
Yeah, so
right?
It's like
in Israel,
it's
nobody used olive oil.
No, this is so weird.
You know, classics. Yeah. And they are already, but, you know, yeah.
No, nobody used olive oil.
Right.
This is Bina, KALW's series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's guests are food writers Einat Admani, author of Shuk, From Market to Table, The Heart of Israeli Cooking, Leah Koenig, author of The Jewish Cookbook, and Adina Sussman, author of Sababa, Fresh, Sunny Flavors from My Israeli Kitchen. They're joined in conversation by Rabbi Zach Kamenetz. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
So now for the experiential, the dining portion of the evening. So we asked all three of you about some fundamental ingredients that you're excited about either in your life or in your book. And we'll just go down the line again. What is one ingredient?
One ingredient
that you are excited about letting people know about, maybe for the first time, through your book.
I'm happy to start if you guys want to.
Sure.
So everybody knows poppy seeds, mon, right? Everybody has them in hamantaschen, and you either love it or you hate it. But poppy seeds go so far beyond hamantaschen. And first of all, are the Wise Sons guys here? Yay. I want to say thank you to them for their generosity and their deliciousness. So the everything bagel onion dip is a recipe there that they contributed to the book, and it's one of my favorites. But
delicious.
Yeah, so poppy seeds have savory applications like that. They're just the most beautiful, like nutty. I hated them growing up because I only ever had like the canned solo, overly saccharine garbage that, you know, is just not that delicious. But you find them in makosh, which is like a rolled poppy seed cake from Hungary, which is in the book, and you find them just all sorts of places, and I think they're really special.
Thank you.
I'm curious to try the ones here.
Yes, and the ones from Burlap and Barrel are particularly delicious, as are all the other spices that they have provided tonight.
I think there is duka that I do that is a little bit different. The one things I do a little bit different, it's with coconut, and most of people don't. And I toast a coconut, a small coconut, and sweet it. So I think it's bringing different layers that, and I do pistachio duka and a lot
of... Duka's like an Egyptian spice
blend. Like a za'atar, but better.
Yeah.
Much better.
It is delicious.
But the one thing that I grew up and I put in a book, it's like kind of bring my memory back. It's something that's called jala. Mm-hmm. And that's something that Yamanite is known as a very poor Jew. They came to Israel with not a lot of money. The dessert, the end of the meal, it's fruit and nuts, and sometimes dry fruit. But there is no dessert. There is no. There is not a lot of meat. It's all about the dough. There is very kind of, and that's to show wealth on the table because nuts was expensive. And the way I do my jala, it's a lot of different seeds. It's super healthy. I put a little bit, tiny olive oil and a little bit sugar and a granulated onion, and I mix everything with a little bit of water and dry it very slow. And there is probably around 10 different things, and you can put it on top of every salad, every dish, and it's really upgrading things.
Wonderful. And there's also the urfa pepper you also recommended to us, and we got some very nice urfa on the table. Do you want to just say a little bit about what people could expect if they taste it?
So urfa, it's super strong and a little bit smoky. It's super interesting things that I actually explored just the last maybe 5 years. It's super dark. It's have very nutty flavor. I used to mix it with some lemon and honey and some orange juice and make marinated for chicken. I have it in the book.
Beautiful.
And then just you can grill it. So it's another way to have a new marinade.
Excellent. Thank you. Adina.
I'm really into a couple of the funkier fermented flavors. So obviously amba is something that a lot of you may already know, but Trader Joe's is now selling amba called mango amba sauce or something.
And a
squeezable bag.
And similar to the fritters, that's a condiment that the Iraqi community from Baghdad who lived in India adapted from like a savory mango pickle, then brought back to Israel, and then when that community immigrated to Israel, it started showing up on falafel and sabich stands, and it sort of has become a national condiment. And What I like about it is, first of all, it's pretty healthy. It's got fenugreek and turmeric and mangoes, and it has a really sour, funky, fermented flavor that is typically used on all kinds of street foods. But in the book, I sort of reconnected it to its kind of Indian or curry roots, and I do a tofu curry, and instead of using curry paste, I use amba with the coconut, and it just gives it like a really tangy but rich flavor. Mm-hmm. And then in that same fermented vein, I bought Persian limes last year, which are these dry, they look like little dried walnuts almost.
The powder on your table.
And I ground them up. I had leftovers, so I ground them up into like a really fine powder, and I mixed them with turmeric and cumin and onion powder and garlic powder, and I cured chicken wings with them and roasted them and then brushed them with pomegranate molasses.
Amazing.
So they have like a really sour, sweet, fermented, funky flavor. And again, it started out as a way just to use something up that I had in a jar, not realizing that limun omani, which is Persian limes or omani limes, you can actually buy in Middle Eastern stores already ground into a powder. So you can do it yourself in your spice grinder, or you can buy a packet of what's called limun omani or limon parsi Persian limes.
Thank you. Also, just to say, in the spirit of the New Year season, the high holiday season, something that I found just that I'm so grateful for all three of you, is a little bit of a window into holiday cooking, either from Mizrahi tradition, Ashkenazi Israeli tradition, and even more places, to continue to build up what I would consider, at least for my family, our traditions, to be able to look at the ways that other Jewish communities are doing things and to feel empowered and inspired to turn them into our traditions. I am not Yemenite, but I feel like bringing Yemenite food into my family is an important step for me to take in the history, like you're mentioning, the evolution of Jewish food and the evolution of Jewish cooking. Putting amba and mayonnaise together, and you put it on pargiot, the shawarma recipe, but I've just started putting it on almost everything. right, and feeling like that
amba
is
mayo?
Amba
it's
mayo.
So good. So good.
That is an extension of my Jewish culture, even though I might not be Iraqi. So I want to thank you for opening up that window for me, my family, other families, and for people who are here tonight to buy your book. I want to now thank you very much just for being able to share stories and your ideas about food and your new books. And now we're going to have some time for questions from the audience.
Einat, we made your sinaya once, your delicious sinaya, and she used some kind of tahini, and it wasn't as thick as it looked. What was your favorite tahini to use for that dish, sinaya?
Oh, sinaya, in the first book.
Yeah,
in Balabusta. I have two that I use mostly. It's Ar Bracha and El Araz, and there is also the White Dove, so there is three. Now you can get them here pretty easy. Yeah. That's the three main one. I think in Israel, everybody used today Ar Bracha mostly. But in New York, you can get El Araz. That's going to be changed to the name Julia. It's easy to remember. That's the and it's a very, very, it's a super smooth tahini and have a great, great volume as well, which is, as a restaurateur, it's pretty important. Delicious. Yeah.
Thank you.
Hi. Did I hear correctly that the largest consumers of tahini in the world per capita are Chinese?
Sesame seeds.
Sesame is a tahini.
Sesame seeds, and tahini is, because of tahini, Israel is the second per capita highest in the
world. Of sesame seeds.
And, you know, Israel has, there are sesame brokers whose only job is to import the best sesame seeds from Humera, which is a fertile region in Ethiopia. Yeah. And if there's like a civil war in Ethiopia on the border, everyone in Israel freaks out because they're worried about, you know, how they're going to have what they need to make their tahina. And tahina is just such a great, most of it is made by Palestinians and Arabs in Samaritans, Har Bracha, and it's nice because Israelis just happily buy it, and it's just one of those examples in Israel of things that happen between Arabs and Jews just naturally, like that aren't a big deal that we don't hear about and talk about, but everyone's talking about their favorite brand with the Dove or the Samaritans and the West Bank who make it, and you know, it's really fun to always discover new brands and also as food writers to be able to go and see it being made is an amazing experience. And, you know, there's a lot of that to explore in Israel if you get to come, going to a place like Nazareth or Akko, and, you know, experiencing the Arab roots of a lot of Israeli dishes is also really fun. So,
thank you. Thank you. I want, just to close, I would like for, I know only one, I'm sorry, but I have a specific recipe that I would just love for you to talk about briefly in the few minutes that we have left. And I'll start with you, Einat. Could you please talk to us about your cauliflower with bamba recipe?
So 7 years ago, I opened a restaurant called Bar Bolognat. It was, I want to embrace, I had Balabusta a few years before that, and Balabusta was more Israeli Mediterranean, but when I opened Bar Bolognat, I really wanted to do a much more modern Israeli. So at the beginning, I was refused to put hummus inside. I said, no hummus. And it's hard because what is Israeli cuisine? So I start like, you know, trying to get work with p'titim, which is, for me, p'titim, it's when my mom didn't have time to cook, you know?
What we sometimes call Israeli couscous.
Israeli couscous. It's not a couscous, yeah?
Couscous.
It's pasta.
Pasta.
But this is, it's so funny. It became such a high-end. When I came to New York, I worked for Bobby Flay and at Bolo, and that's the first things I see. It's and I was like, what? My mom would die now if she sees this.
You know why, right?
Why?
Do you know Mika Sharon,
yeah,
the chef?
Yeah,
so
yeah,
she like brought it.
Yeah, I know.
Okay,
that.
Of course.
I wrote the. Yeah.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah. I did so much research about that because p'titim, when I came in 99, I was shocked about what's going on here. Huh. But the bamba, there is old jokes in Israel that the reason that Israeli relatively don't have much peanut allergies is because of bamba. And when I opened Bar Bolognat, I decided I need to actually embrace the bamba. This is something I really like. And bamba is made with rice and peanuts. So I took flour and I make rice butter and I fry them so they're super, super crispy. And then I make tahini sauce, very lemony. Finish it with lemon zest and a lot of chopped peanuts. So kind of incorporate everything. And then I just chop bamba and put on top with some greens and grated some lemon zest to finish. And it's, people really like it.
It's really good.
It's super crispy. And then you have this bamba that is
I have to say, when I opened the book, I think I wrote to many friends texting. And I said, I took a picture of it and I said, this is amazing.
She's crazy.
This is amazing and bonkers. and I will probably try to make it next Shabbat. So thank you for that. Adina. Israeli street corn.
So I grew up in California. Elote, or, you know, Mexican street corn is something that I love, and that's traditionally, you know, a fresh ear of corn brushed with mayonnaise and then rolled in queso fresco, and it's sprinkled with some chili and lime. And when I got to Israel, you know, corn in Israel is only now starting to be good. Until like 3 or 4 years ago, there was only like it looked good, but it tasted like feed. Like it was
super
starchy and not sweet and not that sort of like Jersey corn experience or California, you know, delicious corn. But now you can get some really good sweet corn. And what I do is instead of mayonnaise, I brush it with labaneh yogurt, which has like a beautiful tartness. And then I roll it in crumbled feta, which looks like queso fresco. And then I sprinkle za'atar on top. And then I zest fresh lime, and I serve it with lime wedges, and I sprinkle it with chili. And it's really easy to make. I mean, all those things are, you know, if the corn is in really high season, I don't even cook the corn, or I just grill it for a minute or two. And you can just do it in 10 minutes, or if you're having a party, like have like an Israeli street corn bar where people can make their own. Mm-hmm. And it's just really refreshing. And again, like it looks like elote, but it tastes so Israeli. And it's, you know, Israelis are really surprised by it also. And at first, like a lot of my book, I worked with an Israeli photography team. And I felt like it was a really good proving ground for a lot of my food because there was a lot of like, what is this? Like, what are you trying to do? And then they would eat it and be like, oh, okay, I get it, you know. Yeah. So that was one of those.
Well, this is another one of those recipes where instead of texting people about it, I just yelled in the kitchen, and my wife came to see like what actually happened. I said, I can't believe she did this. What is she thinking? This is amazing. So thank you for Israeli street corn. And finally, Leah, can you tell us about chamin macaroni?
Yes.
Yeah.
So chamin macaroni is in the cholent family. It's a Shabbat dish that is cooked. In some ways, you guys should be talking about it because you have the Israeli cookbooks. But it's one of the sort of more explicitly Israeli dishes in my book. So it cooks all night, or you know, for many, many hours.
I saw it before.
Jerusalem, I think. I think it's in Israel. It was.
It's not a kugel.
It's not a kugel. It's a chamin. So it's a chamin and cholent are the overnight stews. So basically, it's chicken. You saute onions. You put in cardamom, cinnamon. I have to go back and see all of the spices that are in it. Turmeric, I believe. So you have this really fragrant onion situation, and you layer on top of it the chicken pieces. So then all the fat like drips into the onions, and that in itself, you don't need anything more. But then you layer on top of that bucatini. So macaroni just means spaghetti. You could use spaghetti, but the bucatini with like the little hole in the middle, it just kind of like swells up and it just like soaks up all of the what?
It's good. I want to try it.
Oh, it's so good. It's so good.
It looks really good.
So you basically have this like almost
I
like
love Google is my favorite thing.
I'm totally making both of those Google dishes like immediately. But you basically it like sucks up all the cooking liquid, noodle. So it's kind of custardy, but then you get like the crunchy like noodle top. You cook it in a Dutch oven, and it's just it's super delicious. You have to there's hard boiled eggs in it too, like the long cooked hard boiled eggs.
Wow.
So you kind of have to like scoop all the way down and like get all the layers. And
what, we said October 11, right? Friday night.
we're plotting a dinner in New York.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I did not yell. I did not text. I think I just had a private moment. I can't believe I get to eat all of these things in one dish. This is very exciting. Well, I want to thank all three of you for being here at the JCC tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For
so
writing
fun.
These wonderful books, putting thank them you. Out in the world, and creating new Jewish flavors out of classic old Jewish flavors and continuing this tradition, this iterative process of looking back to look forward, which I think is so fundamental to the Jewish experience, and you're doing it through food and your stories and your connections to different places, where you're from and where you are now. So thank you again.
Thank you.
Thank you all for being here.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guests were food writers Einat Admani, author of Shuk, From Market to Table, The Heart of Israeli Cooking, Leah Koenig, author of The Jewish Cookbook, and Adina Sussman, author of Sababa, Fresh, Sunny Flavors from My Israeli Kitchen. They were joined in conversation by Rabbi Zach Kamenetz. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Alex Espalet, Dan Folds, Carly Mari, and Aiden Nelson. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Tina Pimentuan is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.